Science Weekly.
My name is Dr. John Olson, and I'm the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate Integration Office. Well, right now, we're focusing on completing assembly of the International Space Station. We've got a crew of six, truly international crew, on board as we speak. And just last week, on the 18th of June, we launched the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter with LCROSS as well. And last week, we entered low lunar orbit with that spacecraft. It's doing very well, so we're excited about that. We also have upcoming this fall the Ares 1X flight test, which is the first major flight test of our Constellation program. And the Constellation program is the whole series of vehicles that you see depicted here that's going to be replacing the space shuttle as we look to retire it after the completion of the remaining 8 shuttle flights in the manifest. And so we're definitely busy and we're focused on the future, but it's about going back to the moon. It's about exploring beyond low Earth orbit and looking at doing so in a sustained and an affordable fashion with both commercial and international partnerships to enable that.
So 40 years ago, we were on the moon, but we haven't really gone back since. And now we're planning to go back. I guess, why the gap and why are we going back?
Well, kind of two questions in there. First, the gap. We do have a gap, and that's, as I just mentioned, we have the space shuttle, which is planned for retirement by the end of 2010. And we're going to try and fly out the remaining flights prior to that time, and we think we'll be on track to do so. But we aren't going to bring the new Constellation vehicle online. Its initial operational capability, or IOC as we like to call it, is March of 2015. During that period, we're going to be relying upon the Russians and the Europeans and the Japanese and our commercial industry to do resupply of cargo to the International Space Station. But the second part of the question is about going back to the moon. And per our current plans and policies, we're looking for a human lunar return goal, we call it HLR, of 2020. And of course, we have an independent review of U.S. human spaceflight plans ongoing right now that's due out at the end of the summer in the August timeframe. And that will really help clarify a set of options from which the president and the new administrator of NASA will solidify a course going forward. But we're going back to the moon not for flags and footsteps, but we're going back to the moon for a long-term sustained presence. And we're going to use the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. We're going to look at other interesting spots like asteroids or near-Earth objects, and we're going to look at all the other exciting places to go in the solar system. So the compelling reasons for doing so are, we like to characterize them as like six primary themes. It's about human civilization because it's our innate desire, much like going from the New World or exploring the unknown, is very much even about species preservation in a way. Secondly, going back to the moon, with it being just 3 to 3.5 days away, it's the closest celestial body to the Earth from which to try out and prepare for our further exploration in terms of our systems, in terms of our procedures and our technologies and our countermeasures for the very challenging environment of space. Certainly, there's huge economic potential benefit in terms of economic expansion and bringing the moon into Earth's economic sphere, whether it be in support of commercial communications and navigation or logistics for resupply, much like a shipping company back and forth, as well as the potential energy and manufacturing aspects. So those are three of the themes, and there's six total. The other three would be scientific exploration. And in a sense, the moon holds many exciting opportunities in looking at not only our record of impacts by meteorites, but also looking at comet impacts and looking at the mineralogy of the moon. Also, it's one of the few places that on the backside of the moon, as it's shielded or silent from the Earth's radio frequency noise, and so there's a lot of exciting opportunities there. And we also believe it's going to have radical impacts on our understanding of not only earth science but planetary science and our ability to go beyond. The last two are about global partnerships and working together in a truly collaborative international environment, leveraging the great lessons learned from the International Space Station and building upon that towards peaceful endeavors that benefit all of humanity. That's really what it's about. And finally, last but not least, maybe one of the most important ones, it's about public engagement. It's about getting people to believe that, as we learned 40 years ago by going to the moon, that nothing's impossible if you dedicate the requisite resources and work and commit as a nation, as a human race to that goal. But it's also about educating the next generation, you know, for our innovation or our technology societies and our industrialized societies. It's absolutely essential to continually harness and push the bounds. And so going to the moon excites and builds generations of folks looking at science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and all the other fields that it takes to succeed in the global marketplace. And so In a net, those are the compelling reasons of why we are going and why we need to do so now. It's been 40 years. It's time to go back, but we're going back to stay, and it's not just the moon. It's moon as a stepping stone to much broader and ambitious goals.
One of the elements you mentioned there was species preservation. Just explain a little bit about that, more about that. You mean, you know, humans?
Yes. By having humans explore celestial bodies other than the planet Earth, it's almost like an inherent insurance policy. By having the ability to live on another planet, and so it also is about understanding the fossil record or the impact record or our past. Our past experience that we've had on Earth that oftentimes gets erased by our own environment with wind and water and waves, whereas without an environment or an atmosphere on the moon, it's a perfect recordation mechanism of all the things that have come into the near sphere of the Earth-Moon space. And so as we see over the past 25,000 years of impacts going well beyond that, as we walk back, we can kind of see what our past history on Earth has looked like, and it also helps prepare for the future. Likewise, as we talk about radio telescopes, perhaps on the back side of the moon, on the dark side of the moon, in that quiescent area shielded from the Earth's RF spectrum, it helps us to perhaps with greater sensitivity look for signs of life and other potential contacts out there.
The time scale of looking at something like this is so far in advance, isn't it? I mean, do you even have any kind of handle on how long it would take to kind of research and have that kind of technology available? And what are some of the problems with planning anything so far in advance?
As we look at taking the systems, you know, the closed loops, sustainable, because you can't bring everything with you in terms of consumables. As we look at those type of environmental control and life support systems that are closed, meaning we don't have to, we reutilize everything and are very thrifty and environmentally oriented. As we do that, we're going to need to do that to have the sustained long-term presence on the moon. As we look to an outpost, many of those very elements are already the precursor building blocks for living beyond. Ultimately, you know, we currently have the International Space Station crews go for 180-day expeditions or missions to the space station. So too are we looking to do the same thing on the surface of the moon at our outpost stays. So we're already pursuing that path and taking that journey. And as we go to Mars, with today's technologies, it's currently about a six-month trip to Mars, six-month stay, up to a year stay in order to do useful work, and then about a six-month journey back. So you're looking at a two-year mission, so you're already looking at a fairly significant portion of time for having human beings be off planet. And that certainly presents some challenges, but I think as we've discovered water with the Spirit and Opportunity rover discoveries on the surface of Mars, I think in terms of all of human history, what an exciting time to explore and expand, and that should really energize a lot of folks.
What kind of time scale are we looking at for something like that mission to Mars, you know, two-year mission?
Well, you know, that's a tough question because some of it depends certainly upon budgets, others on technologies, certainly on national and international will and commitment, because a mission of that nature, by the very scope of its challenge and complexity, is going to have to be international. No nation has enough treasure and resources to do it alone, and certainly the benefits to humanity also point towards having a broad partnership. But in terms of timing, again, our independent human spaceflight review team is going to be looking at those goals and objectives, but we notionally have looked at some timelines whereby if we have a human lunar return in 2020, we look at having an outpost in place around the 2024-ish time frame, 2024. And then depending upon the maturation of the technologies and the capabilities and funds, as we've already mentioned, perhaps maybe in the 2030, 2035 time frame, we could start looking for a human mission to Mars. And there are many who would say, you know, that's just not soon enough. We ought to go there sooner. And to that, I would counter, of course, we'd love to go sooner. And I think that's absolutely in mankind's destiny to go to Mars for even more of all those reasons I talked about going to the moon. But we've got to take an affordable and a prudent and a rational approach. And we also have to develop mitigations and countermeasures to those very tough, challenging problems of radiation countermeasures, psychology, closed-loop systems, planetary protection, both protecting the planet Mars as well as protecting the planet Earth. And so we will probably need to do Mars sample return missions prior to that to get those techniques and procedures down, to do more robotic reconnaissance and more planning of landing sites and characterization of the environment. So it's an integrated systems engineering problem, or it's an integrated story, and we're building each of the chapters in order to have the whole book.
Now, it's not cheap going to Mars, especially, I mean, it's a question as well that's been around since you were on the moon. Is it worth it? How much should it cost? In these financial times we're in at the moment, I mean, what's NASA's take on the cost of all this?
Well, we're currently focusing on going back to the moon, and per both our policies and our laws that are in place, that's our focus. And as I mentioned, it's a focus as a stepping stone to a Mars forward strategy. But In answering either of those questions, whether is it affordable, is it prudent to go to the moon, is it affordable or prudent to go to Mars, and I would say as a counter, how can we not? If we look at Apollo, where the tangible benefits, somewhere between $7 to $10 return for every dollar invested, I think in these tough economic times, anyone would love to have that stock in their portfolio right now. But I think it's much broader than that. If we look at the benefits of peaceful, cooperative work, if we look at the benefits to society, if we look at in these tough times where it's easy to get down about the outlook and the future and about our current state of affairs, the unbelievable, unbelievable energizing impact of accomplishing the impossible dreams, the things that are truly hard, the things that are truly rewarding, I think far outweigh the cost. And right now, we're only one-half of 1% of the U.S. federal budget goes to NASA's budget. And if you look at the return on investment and the long-term benefits, I think it's absolutely essential that we do that. And it also helps us with the environment, the economy, healthcare, energy, all those tough, challenging problems, all the ones of today are precisely why we need to go. If that's not enough, if you are to adopt a sheerly conservative approach and say we should spend nothing in these tough times on space, then why would we have sporting events and movie theaters and all of the pastimes? And it's a part of the human spirit. It's a part of quality of life. But it's about taking a step back and seeing the realm of the possible, the realm of truly exciting our people.
And this is a bit of a bizarre question. I was listening to an interview from Professor Martin Rees, who's president of the Royal Society back in the UK, and he was talking about the future of space travel. He wasn't criticizing, but he was highlighting how safe NASA is in terms of, you know, risk-taking. And maybe the program is too safe. It sounds unusual.
I've heard that statement or those statements or those concepts before, and I would put them in a little different light. Certainly when we went to Apollo, or in the Apollo program, we went to the moon the first time, we took... There was actually a huge amount of risk assumption. There was a lot of unknown, and certainly we had folks who accepted that challenge and excelled, and we managed to safely execute all the missions to the moon. Even with Apollo 13, you know, we had an amazing team that came up with creative solutions to solve the challenges there. But I think part of this is a reflection of society. We're very intolerant, whether it be in wars or whether it be in transportation or in anything, of the value of human life is intrinsically important. And so too have we learned from the very two tragedies that we had with the shuttle program, with the Challenger and Columbia, the tremendous loss, the down period in recovering from those tragedies, but as we look to going forward, space truly is a really challenging environment. And so as we look to make it as safe as possible, and we look at things like loss of crew, LOC, and loss of mission, LOM, we analyze our different options or our different transportation architectures or our launch vehicles or our total systems with those and looking at reliability and performance. But it's really always going to be a very challenging mission. We're trying to do so and make it safe by balancing prudent risk assumption with cost benefit. And so many of our astronauts have been through test pilot school, either test pilots or flight test engineers. I too am a graduate of our Air Force Test Pilot School, and what that teaches you is it teaches you that mentality is you can never eliminate all of the risk, but you do prudent risk assumption, and I think that's very much the sense of our astronaut corps in adopting or accepting or doing these missions. Likewise, it's the sense of the whole cultural norm of NASA that we want to make it as absolutely safe as possible, but we want to go do the mission. Of course, if we just stayed on the Earth, it's 100% safe, but that's not viable. So it's got to be a mix and it's got to be a blend, and that's what we're doing. But it also has to be affordable, and we have to go do these missions. And then we are pioneering, we are blazing a trail and doing things that are inherently risky. And so I think by the fact of all of our ambitious goals and what we're looking to do, and on the timeframes that we're looking to do them, I think it's just weighing all the factors and hitting an optimal mix between those.
I guess with more commercial partners or other countries involved now, that's going to increase the risk. They may take more risks, I guess, than NASA has learned to take. And you know, there's some suggestion as well there'd be one-way tickets for missions. I mean, what do you make of those?
Yeah, it's interesting perspective. I might even throw it out differently. I mean, the U.S. commercial industry is very much looking to kind of expand or grow from this nascent high potential body. Likewise, we're seeing a strong propagation, and it's very exciting around the world. You know, you've got Japan and China and India and other countries, even the UK, with Great Britain having its first astronaut selectee, and you know, BNSC, British National Space Center, being very engaged in our global exploration strategy. I think as you look at that composite, what we've learned is having other deferring philosophies, other deferring transportation systems or architectural elements or contributions, that adds to the richness and the robustness. We like to call it, you know, a technical term, we call it dissimilar redundancy. By having a different approach, if you have a challenge with one, you've always got a backup. You don't have any common cause failures, or you eliminate some of those. And so I think it can be very helpful from a long-term perspective. Case in point, the International Space Station. While the U.S. Space Shuttle fleet was grounded, we were able to sustain and actually execute science and valuable and productive work and construction and assembly work on board the International Space Station through our partners in the Russian space program with Soyuz and Progress. I think we've only expanded that portfolio as we look at, you know, the Europeans, the Japanese, the commercial sector. I think it's a good, diverse portfolio, again, back to that economic metaphor.
What about the concept of a one-way ticket?
You know, I think you'd find no shortage of volunteers for a one-way ticket. Because of the benefits, for example, to Mars, but I think that has broader implications. What are the societal implications of that? What are I think that's broader than just a technical solution. And I think that's actually a very good topic for kind of philosophical debate. Is NASA willing to do that? No, our national policy, the U.S. Space Exploration Policy, says, just like John F. Kennedy did, our goal is to send our crews to do human exploration and then safely return them. So that's our national mandate.
On an untried mission to an unknown celestial body and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere.
And yet, I don't think for others or for the future, you know, there very well may be missions due to the limitation of the human lifetime that ultimately we may do one-way trips, and we may look at that. And I think it's really no different than the pioneering spirit of many in past history took the one-way trip across the ocean or the trip out west from the United States with no intentions of ever returning and living off the land and exploring and expanding and exploiting the opportunities that were there. So I think back to that human civilization theme of going to the moon, I think that may very well be a strong part of our internal makeup for some.
Science Weekly.